on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday about quantum algorithm, ideas of using quantum mechanics to manipulate information to do something which is more efficient than what classical device would be able to do. We've heard about ideas of quantum searching, quantum factoring, and all those algorithms. Tomorrow we'll hear from Barbara there all about physics simulation, how we can simulate quantum physics on devices. All of this is theory, and except for the talk of Daniel yesterday, then nothing was related to implementing this in physical devices that we have around us. And complementing the work, the kind of talk of Daniel, I'm going to talk about nuclear magnetic resonance and how we can implement some of these ideas in systems like that. If we're interested of turning the theory of quantum information to the practice, we have to start thinking about trouble that will kind of come in. Imprecision, imperfection, errors of real devices, we have to start to face them. And many talks that we've heard yesterday and today were in that direction. In fact, up to 5 years ago, until Peter Shore, which is just coming in at a very good moment, and Andrew Steen discovered error correction, we knew that if we would not be able to control the errors, they will compound. And they would, in fact, take over the advantages that quantum information would have brought us. With error correction and the accuracy threshold that many talked about, then we know today that with a reasonable amount of overhead and more and resources, which are reasonable also, we should be able to take care of errors. That's all in theory. Like, we have a nice framework to do this. Is it really true in practice? Can we really implement these ideas of quantum information in real devices? And the answer of, can we do it today? Can we do something with a quantum device which do things much more efficiently than a classical device? The answer is no. And the reason is that we don't have enough control on the device. And my talk, I hope, will give you an idea of attempts to find or to learn how to control the system and try to do things with them so that in the future we'll end up with kind of real efficient quantum devices and turn all this beautiful theory into some practical systems. So I should mention my collaborator, Manny Knill, who's around, who's kind of been working, we've been working together on these NMR experiments. Rudy Martinez, the chemist, we'll see a picture of him in a few minutes. Wojciech Zurek, the whole group of David Corey at MIT. We've been kind of exchanging students and postdocs to do some of these experiments. A bunch of students, we came to Los Alamos to do some of that stuff. It's really important when you go from the idea of this beautiful theory of quantum information to practice to see that it's quite a step. And this is kind of a pictorial way to explain my point. Like, here's the theory of factoring, quantum searching, error correction. It's all nice and kind of great. And there we are. And you can see that it's great with Photoshop. You can adapt the pictures. Yes?
I didn't know any experiments worked that well.
Yes. And, well, you don't see there's a flap on that tire. In that picture, on the other hand, this is really kind of what we can think about how much information processing we've been, or quantum information processing we've been doing. This is not to kind of insult the experiment list, because some of the experiments that have been done on quantum information or foundation of quantum mechanics are really tour de force, are really extraordinary. So they're not really on a bicycle in this sense of experimental or physics, but from an information point of view, we're really, really at the beginning. And in fact, all of you students and postdocs are really in a good time because things are going to increase. Like, we're just starting, and when you're starting a new field, experimental quantum physics, then there's a lot of things to do. There's lots of things to be discovered and possibilities and interesting thing to look for. So I've given a little overview of why I want to do why am I doing experiments on NMR? And the main idea is try to understand how to bring quantum information to the physics and try to understand what are the troubles and what are the clever ideas to get around those troubles. So I'll first talk about elements of nuclear magnetic resonance, how the nuts and bolts work, and then I'll describe a few experiments, and depending on how much time I have, and I have to watch out for Daniel, who's kind of going to cut me at the appropriate time, then I'll stop at some point and then conclude of what have we learned out of this, and where should we go. Before I go on the element of NMR, I should point out that I will describe most of the experiments that I've been involved too, but there's a large set of different experiments done with nuclear magnetic resonance, starting with experiments of David Corey demonstrating a simple kind of gate in 1996, two experiments with 4, 5, 6, 7 qubits that have been done more recently. Also, this list does not include everybody. I think I roughly finished my list sometime last summer, and then kind of you can see that at the end, the more recent one, I'm missing the last one, but it gives you an idea of who are the players in this field. Mostly MIT, there's kind of two groups at MIT, David Corey's group in the nuclear engineering department. There is Neil Gershenfeld and Ike Chuang at the Media Lab, Jonathan Jones at Oxford, Ike Chuang, who was at IBM, who's moved to MIT. There's a few groups in India and China, and there's a group at Los Alamos, including Manny, myself, and students. So this will be my most important transparency, going through an overview of things, and I'll go a little bit more in details. But here's the overview of how NMR, quantum information processing, works. Well, first thing, we have to find some qubits. So we find qubits at looking at the magnetic moments of a nuclear spin. Very naively, you can think about them as little magnets. So you can think of the magnet pointing up. Let's call this the zero state, pointing down the one state. And we can take this magnet and make it in superposition of up and down. And I'm going to think about this as kind of pointing in a different direction. So if I take a quantum state, which would look like cos of theta of 0 plus sine of theta e to the I phi 1, I can map this in terms of density matrices. So this is psi. So I'll take the density matrix, which is written in that form, and I'm going to write this density matrix in terms of Pauli matrix, and I'm going to use the same notation that Manny Knill used. So the Pauli matrix sigma x, sigma y, sigma z will be written as x, y, and z. So I'll forget about that sigma. When this doesn't seem to be too much confusion, I won't put any index, but if there's many index corresponding to different qubits, I'll put a 1 or a 2 at the bottom to say which one it corresponds to. So if I write this in terms of Pauli matrix, it turns out that any density matrix of a single qubit can be written in terms of 3 Pauli matrix plus the unit. Well, I'll kind of put the unit as a Pauli matrix too, so I'll call them 4 Pauli matrix. So I can write this as 1/2. So my final sign is the unit density matrix plus cos theta, sine theta, cos phi x plus sine theta sine phi y plus cos of theta z. So I've just used this state here, multiply it that way, and wrote it in terms of the Pauli matrix. Is there anybody who doesn't know what the Pauli matrix are? Is there anybody who knows what the Pauli matrix are? I don't have the union of one here. So there are people who are superpositioned between knowing and not knowing. So this one is the matrix which is of this form. This one is 0, 0, minus 1. And y, always up to a sign, is this one. Okay? And if you want to remember the sign, is that x times y is equal to iz. That's the only way I can remember. And I think I'm all right. Yes. So I had the right kind of sign convention. So I can, now I've written all of this in terms of equation. Pictures are quite often easier. also, many already introduced the pictures, which is called the block sphere. So this is Z, X, Y, and I'm going to be sometimes kind of confusing people by using this X, Y, Z as thinking about those X, Y, and Z of the Pauli matrices, and the X, Y, Z, the Euclidean space. But quite often, it doesn't matter. The confusion is kind of for physicists. Mathematicians will probably throw me tomatoes by the end I finish. But physicists will say, okay, that's all right. I have a spin pointing that direction. If the matrix is such that this is 1 and the rest is 0, this X corresponds also to this spin pointing in this direction. So here, on the surface of that sphere, I have the pure states. And if I look at one direction, like this is the theta, the angle between X and Y in that plane is the phi, and one arrow in this corresponds to my spin. So that's why I'm going to talk about quantum states, let's say, of that way or of this form, pointing in some particular direction. So that's what my spins, I can think of my spins are. So if we have hydrogen and carbon are made of different kind of nucleons, so they have a slightly different magnetic moment, so they can be distinguished from each other. In fact, if I put these nuclear spin in a very strong field in the Z direction, I have an Hamiltonian, which is nu, the magnetic moment, times the field. I take the field being the B direction in the Z direction. I'll assume that, let's say, it's 11 Tesla, 10 to the 5 Gauss. The magnetic field of the Earth, I think, is half a Gauss. So that gives you how strong this magnetic field is. And then if you have the magnetic moment of the spin, what you get here is that for the hydrogen, omega is about 500 megahertz. And this is the Pauli matrix, so this is my Hamiltonian for a single spin. If I have another spin, then I'll put an index and I'll say omega 2, Z2. And for the carbon, the magnetic moment is such that the frequency corresponds to 125 megahertz. So I think of my little spin as a magnet, and I put this in a very strong magnetic field in the Z direction. So if I put them, if I use another magnetic field to apply a torque on this, put this in the XY plane, it's going to rotate at the frequency, which is this Larmor frequency that I've just put in here. So it does rotate very fast, 500 megahertz. One thing which is incredibly good with today's spectrometers is that they have incredibly good timing. And what we do when we want to go and do information processing with NMR is follow the wave function very well and make it kind of do all kind of little dance of those spins. And yes, to do this, you can do this only if you can follow the spin at these velocities, because they are going very, very fast. And suddenly you say, I want to put it back in this axis. Well, you want to be sure that if you make a rotation around the x-axis, you want to know if it is at x or at y. Nothing would happen at x. At y, it is going to come back. So you have to follow this. Well, it turns out that these spectrometers are incredibly good. The timing is essentially perfect for what we're doing. So it follows them. It's the least of our problem, let's put it that way. So this is how we get our nuclear, our qubits. They are little magnets here. Well, you've noticed that I have a little 13 here. Carbon 12 has a spin 0. No magnet. Cannot do anything with them. Carbon 13, great, spin half. Then you can go and manipulate them. But here we have two of those carbon, carbon 1, carbon 2. How do we know that there's two, and how do we distinguish them? If they would both have 125 megahertz, okay, if we see them spinning at the difference when they emit photons at that frequency, we can see them individually. It turns out that the electrons cloud around it shield the magnetic field slightly different from one carbon and the other. And it's going to change slightly the frequency. And this is called a chemical shift. Chemical shift can go from 0 to, for carbon, about 20 kilohertz on with a magnetic field of the strength of 10 Tesla. So this is the maximum we can distinguish between two. It's important to have as large possible frequency between the two, because you remember when you try to hit one without hitting the other in frequency space, the time that he can use is 1 over the difference of the frequency. So if he has things between, let's say, kilohertz, he tells you that you cannot hit one without hitting the other in more than millisecond time. So, but you go and choose the appropriate molecule. In a few seconds, I'll go and tell you how do we go and choose molecule. And there. So that's the first ingredient of where the qubit comes in. And I've naively said, kind of put some glints about how do we manipulate those. These are all magnets. Remember your first course of electromagnetism. You have a magnet in this direction. You put another magnetic field in this direction. It's going to induce a torque with the third finger and then start to rotate. Well, that's what happens when you put the spin not in the Z direction, but the XY. There's a torque and makes it rotate. But you can use the same idea, sending a pulse at that frequency. So if you go in the rotating frame of that spin, then it looks like a constant magnetic field. And with this constant magnetic field, if you put it in the X direction or Y direction, you can take a pulse, a spin which started at Z and going down, let's say, between X and Y axis, depending on which direction your magnetic field is in. So that's how you do one-bit gate. So maybe I should put a little list. I talked about qubits, then briefly mentioned gates. There's also two-bit gate, and I'm going to talk about them a little bit. Naively, you could think about them as two little magnets. They'll have an interaction between them, and then that's how kind of they act on each other. This happened on a much smaller scale. Like the single qubit gate of 1 over delta, delta was the chemical shift. That's about a millisecond. The two-bit gate, this interaction, is about 100 hertz. So you can do things at 10 milliseconds. So this is very good. You have all scales which are all different. So you can do things kind of at different scale and can think about, let's say, single bit gate on millisecond is roughly instantaneous compared to the two-bit gate. So I'll make those approximations today saying that when we do one-bit gate, you're not doing any two-bit gate. One thing you have to remember, however, is that the two-bit gate compared to the ion trap we've heard yesterday is that it's always on. So there's a term in the Hamiltonian, which we'll call the J coupling, which is of the form Z1, Z2. And I'll explain a little bit later how does that work. So we've gone through qubit, gates. It's always good to have an idea of noise in our system. And it turns out that there's two types of noise comes in NMR. And the reason is, they are parameterized by only two numbers, and the reason is everything is symmetric with respect to the z-axis, and it kind of simplified other things. The decoherence time, the time at which this phase here gets randomized, the phi, and this is called T2. And T2 is about 1 second, which is not incredibly great, but much better. But it's reasonable compared to a 10 millisecond two-bit gate. So we can do about 100 gates before things go bad. Well, I see Gilles is not happy. We'd like to have better. This is the last before transparency. There'll be something improving in this direction. There's also relaxation. Relaxation is you put your spin kind of upside down. It takes some time to come back because of interaction with phonon modes and kind of molecules colliding with each other. And that's between 5 to 30 seconds. So it's not the perfect quantum computer or quantum information processing device. Many told us that if we wanted something to be scalable, we'd like to arrive to this threshold. We don't know exactly what the threshold is, but if it would be 10 to the minus 6, if we take the ratio between this to this, we get about 1 over 100, 10 to the minus 2. So we still have some work to do, but we have to start somewhere. And the last thing I needed to talk about is the initial state. And usually, or like in ion trap, what we do is make the bits go back to zero. Here, things are a little bit subtle in NMR, and I'll have a transparency which explains this. So let's go back to the gate for a second. Oh, choosing the molecule before going to the gate. I've put pictures of molecule, and we have to decide, like, is a molecule good or not, and what are the criteria? So one of the criteria is that we want to have this chemical shift. Like we have two carbon, like in that molecule, which is called carbonic acid, we have four carbons. We want the carbon to be far away from each other. If they're not far away from each other, it'll take us a lot of time to make these one-bit gate. So So we go to big books. People have been doing nuclear magnetic resonance for a long time. And they have huge catalogs. So you become what the French call rat bibliothèque. You go in those big books looking at one spectrum after the other. So you say, I want 3 qubits. And then you turn the pages, and this turn the pages. And then suddenly you find eureka. You find a molecule which is reasonable. So these, this is the spectrum, the Larmor frequency for the carbon 4, carbon 3, carbon 2, and carbon 1. And if there would be better resolution, it would tell us what is the chemical shift between those two things. And the experiments we've been doing between those two is about 2 kilohertz. So you can go in those big books and find molecules which are appropriate to what you want to do. The next thing you want to be sure is that the decoherence time, the noise time, is large. So suppose that we have a molecule with large chemical shift, but the decoherence time is the speed at which you have interaction between the qubit, it would be useless. So then you have your favorite chemist, our friend Rudy, who goes, synthesize some of these molecules, and then we go and look at how much time it takes to decohere, and then we tabulate all of this, and we get the value, which is reasonable. In this molecule here, the T2s, the decoherence time, are about a second. And the last thing we want is a strong coupling. So we want to have strong coupling between nearby qubits, so we can have gate between them. And we go and look again to see in these molecules how it goes. Well, some of these things are already tabulated, that you know that if you have a double bond between two carbon, the interaction is stronger. Interaction between hydrogen and carbon is stronger. But, for example, carbon 1 to carbon 2, it's a bit weak. And then you decide in the imperfect world which is the best option that you have. And you finally say to Rudy, go and synthesize lots of this, and then we'll be happy and do some experiments. So Rudy is there. I think he had a rough day that day. He was halfway pleased of the synthesis that he had done. But that's how we go and look at molecules. There's another trick also is you go to the chemistry department at your university, and you talk to a good synthetic chemist, and he's going to give you a lot of hints about which are the good candidates, and you don't have to spend that much time in at the library. Okay, so let's go back to the gate. There are 3 sets of gates that we're using in NMR, in the experiments we've been doing. The first set is the one-bit gate. So we have a molecule, we have one spin that we want to do something with it, and we want to go in, rotate it in one direction. So let's assume it starts in the Z direction. And we send a field which corresponds to a magnetic field in the X direction. And if we leave this for a certain amount of time, a certain power is going to rotate. We stop, but it stops to rotate. So by either changing the length of time or the power, we can make a pi over 2 rotation in that system. So here's the picture for the physics point of view. From the mathematics point of view, the operation that we apply is something of the form e to the minus I theta x, which you can expand in that form. And if you look at what happened to z under this, so this is e to the minus I theta x z e to the plus I theta x. And I think I forgot the factor of 2 in there. What happens is z rotates indeed the way you expect from classical system. It goes from pointing up, goes to minus y, minus z, y, and come back up. If you do a rotation around y, then you kind of change the appropriate thing, and you can think it as rotation of the sphere. So that's how you do rotation. You can do rotation with the device, the machine that we have, the typical spectrometer. You can do rotation around any point in the xy axis. However, we can do rotation around the z axis. And these ones are really good rotation, because the system by itself rotates. So instead of and it rotates very fast compared to anything else. So what you can do is you just wait for a fraction of the 1 over that time. And if you do this, then what you thought was the x and the y axis has become the y and the minus x axis. And then you can go in. So these, because the timing in these machines is very good, the z-axis rotation come essentially for free, and they are incredibly, incredibly precise. If you have So I'm going to forget about the hard and soft pulses. Let's go down to the 2-bit gate. So you remember that this theorem that if you do 1-bit gate and you have 2-bit gate, then you can do whatever you want. But here's kind of example of this that you can, I've mentioned the 1-bit gate. I'm going to go to the 2-bit gate. Here's the Hamiltonian. Do people see that where it's kind of, so the Hamiltonian is Z1, Z2. So what does that mean? It means that, let's say that the first spin is pointing up. And the eigenvalue of this is plus then, so that this looks like a plus Z for the second spin. So if we have the first spin pointing up, the second spin will have a Larmor frequency, which is slightly larger. So it'll rotate a little bit faster. If the first spin is pointing down, because Z1 is 1, 0, and 0, 1 over there, it would be minus 1 pointing down, you'll have a minus Z2, so the Larmor frequency would be a little bit slower. So depending on what is the state of the first qubit, the second qubit is going to behave slightly differently. And because the whole thing is symmetric, you can think about it the other way around. So this is a conditional gate. It does something to the qubit depending on what is the state of the first qubit. And once you have this, you can go and see how those things, put them together and look how they look. So here's L. So this is the carbon. And the carbon to either go clockwise or anticlockwise. And this frame of the Larmor frequency. So one looks like it goes a little bit faster. The other one goes a little bit slower. And with this, I'll show in a few minutes how you can make a control nut, for example. The Z field being completely homogeneous, we make a linear gradient. So if you take a spin running exactly in the same spin, to start with, we put a linear. No, list or not. Yes, it works. Well, I'm not sure I'm a real experimentalist anyway. But so we start the system at thermal equilibrium. Remember, omega is 500 megahertz. So if you take omega h bar omega divided by kT, you go and calculate this, and you get 10 to the minus 4 10 to the minus 5. which tells you that most of the spin are completely randomly mixed. Like half of them are fraction pointing in this direction, another fraction in this direction, one fraction in the direction, one fraction in the other direction, except for a very small excess, about 100,000 of them pointing one direction. In fact, all the experiments we do is to take advantage of this very, very small fraction. If you expand the density matrix, because beta is very small, you can expand it as I minus beta HDML and natura, and you do unitary transformation, it will never affect the unit part and just affect this part. And that's what NMR, quantum information processing, relies on, the fact that we have a small amount and we can get some information. But how do we go and get the initial state? The first idea that you could think of is, if you have systems which are completely, mostly random, but with a little bit of order, you could decide to go and accumulate the order, like just kind of concentrate it, kind of purify it. And in principle, it is possible to do this. So you could go and take a little bit of order and then transfer it always to the same spin until the spin is completely parallelized and really pointing up. If you do this, however, the amount of resources that it takes you, like the number of spin that you need to use to have one spin completely parallelized, if you start with a value of beta, goes like 1 over beta squared. Well, if beta is equal to 10 to the minus 5, 1 over beta squared is 10 to the 10. Well, it's possible. Like, my friends, the computer scientists, are happy because it's polynomial. But my other friends, the spectroscopists, are pretty puzzled because they have to manipulate 10 to the 10th spin and when the time relaxation time is about 10 times the number of gates that we can do. So, yeah, it is in the same molecule. So, great idea. Not totally useful. So that was another idea by Havel and Corey and Gershenfeld and Chuang. And the idea is to turn this Hamiltonian in something which looks that way. I'm not going to explain exactly how to do this in detail. But the idea, again, is if we can turn this, where this looks like a pure state, then this part doesn't get affected by unitary transformation, but this one is going to do exactly what we would like to in on a quantum computer. The little problem with this is that when people went to look at what epsilon looks like, it's such that epsilon goes like some constant C, 2 to the n. So as you increase the number of spin, then the signal that you'll get out of this is going to go down exponentially. For n equal to 1, it's not too bad. N equal to 2 is not too bad. And with the spectrometer that we have around today, we can probably go to n between around 10, let's say. So what I'm going to talk, what I've been talking to and talk to on NMR quantum computation today in the liquid state, we'll end up with an N about 10. Well, there's no other device today we can go to 10, so we're a little bit in advance. And once we arrive around 10, then we can start thinking about ways out. And there are ways out, and I'll mention one of them. In fact, this tells you that NMR quantum computation in the liquid state is not scalable. It goes with pseudo-pure state of that form. And also that it doesn't beat classical computers, at least in terms of resources that we are asking. So why are we doing all of this?
It is scalable because it's so quick. You can't even get it started, but it is scalable.
With your definition, if there would be no noise, it would be scalable. But with noise, it is not. So it's great to have this piece of equipment in the lab and say, it is scalable. And I will quote Gilles on this. I said, Gilles tells me, assures me it's scalable. For most algorithms, all the algorithms that we've heard here, we have to start with pure state. But there's algorithms where we might not need to start with pure state. And one of these algorithms was something which was developed with Manik Neil, where I'll make a small diagram. Suppose that we have a pure state or a pseudo-pure state for only one qubit. And then we make Adamar transform. Did Adamar transform came out before? Okay, good. These are supposed to be straight lines. So we have a density matrix rho here, and then we do a control unitary U, and then we go and measure here the expectation value of sigma z. So Adamar, Adamar. It turns out that the expectation value of sigma z is the trace of rho U, real part. And suppose that you go and take rho, which would be a completely mixed state. For any classical computer scientist, this would be complete nonsense. Like, you start with garbage, and you would get garbage out. But here, in quantum mechanics, things are slightly different, because even if you have very mixed state, some phase can be carried around. And even if you have this state being the unit density matrix, you're calculating the trace of this unitary operation. And that's very hard to do on a classical system. So many, Neil and myself, suggested this and suggested that this was a model of computation which was between quantum computation with pure state and classical computation, and it would make NMR scalable in that sense. The pseudo pure state with only one qubit pseudo pure is scalable as long as there's no noise. So here's another initial state that we started. But I should have said, everything I'm going to talk from now on is using a pseudo pure state on this form. Okay. So I've gone through quite a lot of elements of gates, the qubit, and all this. I'm trying to bring all this together and give you the first quantum algorithm that you can do in a small device, which is this famous control knot. The control knot, again, is you start this two qubit. One is the control, the other one the target. If the control is zero, nothing happens. If the control is one, it flips the target. So this is the gate that I would like to construct, and I'm going to do one bit gate in my interaction with two bit gates of the form Z1, Z2, and control this control knot using my fundamental operation. So the basic idea is, let's say on this molecule, I have my carbon 1, carbon 2, I want to do a control knot between each other, and I can translate all of this into this series of operation. I first do a rotation around the y-axis by 90 degrees of my spin. I do one of those Z1, Z2 coupling for time, which is pi over 2, so my Hamiltonian will look like e to the pi over 4 Z1, Z2. There's always a factor of 2 coming in because we're dealing with spin half particles, so do not worry. As long as you remember your convention comes in. So I do this pi over 2 coupling. I do a Z rotation, Y rotation, X rotation. And my claim is that I end up there. Is that obvious? Okay. So here's my little experiments to show you that it's a reasonable example. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to do only those two gates, those two initial states, 0, 0, and 1, 0, and show you that I end up there and there. So the kind of pinkish one is carbon 1, and the red one is carbon 2. And so here I start 0, 0, it's both pointing up, and this one is the 1, 0, so the pink one, C1, is pointing down, 1, and 0 initially. I do my first rotation, Y rotation, 90 degrees. Well, this is the X axis, Y axis, Z axis. So rotation around the Y axis by 90 degrees, you should end up do something like this. Is that reasonable? Yeah. Now I'm going to do this pi over 2 coupling, the ZZ coupling. Oh, you remember, this one is pointing up, so this one will go a little bit faster. This one is pointing down, so it will go counterclockwise, or clockwise and the counterclockwise. Slightly different way, which is the ZZ coupling happening. Pi over 2 angle, so we have those two gates. This is the conditional gate, which depend, which happened on one gate compared to the other. Oh, there we are. So we have done the next gate here. Now we do the Z rotation and the Y rotation. Z rotation on Z1, but they are already in the Z direction. Nothing happened. Y rotation on C2, they're already in the Y direction. So nothing happened to them. And so we can go and do the X rotation. I do the X rotation, and then you end up to something which is that form. And indeed, C1, C2 ended up to 0, 0 here, and this one ended up at 1, 1 pointing down. So now you've seen your first control knot doing a very simple NMR experiment. And so how it works is that you send a pulse at this time, you leave the system evolve so that the coupling up there takes for a right amount of time, so we have the Hamiltonian comes like a pi over 4. You do those two rotation, didn't matter, and this X rotation, and you end up with a control knot. So you might ask, why did I do those two Z and the Y rotation in there? It's because I was worried that there would be a smart ass in the audience who would say, but if you take a superposition of the 0, 0, and 0, 1, you'll end up all this, and you'll have the wrong phase at the end. And indeed, this is what's happening. There's some phase which comes in, and these two things take care of this. So this is the answer why you have this. Second comment about this is, now you might be very puzzled, because I've explained the one-qubit gates classically by kind of pointing with my fingers. I've explained the two-qubit gate also with kind of showing my fingers going up and down in the kind of little diagram like this. So you might say, what's quantum in this? Like, is this thing completely classical? Is there anybody with an answer of why this looks all classical, but in some sense is supposed to be a talk on NMR quantum information? Nobody daring. Yes, Joe. Exactly. So if I go and do a superposition of 0 plus 1 for the control state, the 0 plus 1, if I go back here, correspond to only x. I would start with one of the spins in the x direction. Classically, I would not know what the z interaction does, and maybe you would assume that nothing happens. But if you go through the whole thing, like you started with one spin here in the x direction, and then what you end up when you do the control knot is something like 0, 0 plus 1, 1. So I would need to have two of those diagrams doing this. In fact, if you continue doing this, the number of diagrams, if you do a control knot and a control knot and all this, you end up with two of the n to the n little diagram that you need to explain all of this. And here's where the quantum stuff comes in. So that was a control knot, how this thing works. So once we have this little diagram, we want to turn this into the experiment itself. So we'll write this in a language where we say pulse on the carbon 2, 90, on this atom by 90 degree. Let's do the 90 degree, the ZZ interaction for an amount of pi over 2 between C1 and C2. Then we have the Z pulse, C1, and all of this. And then we write all of this in that way. And Manny Kneel wrote a nice little kind of precompiler who optimized some of the imperfection of some of the pulse, which translated in the language that a spectrometer can understand, which is the language up here. So with all this thing, then we can turn some of these ideas of kind of make a gate into something which is pre-happening in the device. And then we can go and look at the spectra coming out of this and say, yes, this is what has happened in the system or not. Now, there's one last thing I want to mention on this view graph. Is I said the interaction between those two qubits are always on. And I didn't bother too much because I assumed that all those gates here were instantaneous. But there's one thing is that there's still an interaction between the hydrogen and the carbon 1, which is also on all the time. So this are going to kind of send my kind of vector in Hilbert space hash tree. So how do I get rid of that interaction? And this is something that people in NMR knew very well how to do. And it's called refocusing. So we have a Hamiltonian which is between, let's say, hydrogen and carbon 1 for a certain amount of time t to do the pi over 2 coupling between C1 and C2. But we don't want to have this. So how do we get rid of it? And the idea is, so we have a certain amount of time t between disk and egg. If in the middle we do a rotation of the hydrogen by an angle pi over 2, do this Hamiltonian on the hydrogen. So what's going to happen is we do this D1. Whoops. Then we're going to do our rotation pi over 2 XH. We're going to continue this interaction for the second half, and then put another of those poles on H, which with, instead of pi over 2, minus pi over 2. Now you can expand this, and it turns out that this looks like XH, this looks like XH, and this looks like some cos of T over 2, 1, minus I, Z1, Z2, multiplied by sine of T over 2. X and X doesn't do anything on 1. But on the ZH, it changes sign. Remember that X, Z, X. This gives IY. And X multiplied by Y gives IZ. So all this gives minus Z. So it shifts the sign here. So we can forget about this and think that the sign has been shifted up here also. But if the sign has been shifted, it cancels this one. So again, what's happening is, you remember my little diagram when I had the spin up and it was rotating clockwise on counterclockwise? What you're doing is you leave it run for a while and then you shift its side, so it's going to rotate back where it comes from. So this idea, you can cancel the interaction that happened between H and C1 during that time here. So that's one trick that NMR people do. And with this, you can control all the Hamiltonian the way you want. So now what we're left with is taking some of these ideas and making something which is slightly more complicated. So example of things that we've heard before is quantum error correction. It turns out that in NMR, phase error occur at a rate which is faster than bit flip errors. About kind of factor of 5 faster. So we can go and correct for phase error before going and correct for bit flip error. And that's an example that we've implemented a few years ago. So very quickly, this is the circuit that we've been doing. This is the famous control knot again. So it goes from a state which is alpha 0 plus beta 1, one control knot, two control knots between the first qubit second, first qubit and third, which is going to transform this initial state in alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. Then you do a wire rotation 90 degrees. That's a little bit like an Adamar. It changes the state 0 and 1 to the state plus or minus. The state plus or minus is 0 plus or minus 1. So this is going to turn this into alpha plus plus plus, beta minus minus minus. Reason why we do this. Phase error corresponds to applying a Z operator. The Z operator on this state here is going to do nothing on the 0, but saying flip the sign on the 1. So it's going to take plus, send it to minus, and minus going to plus. So we implement the code that Manny talked about on phase error. So if nothing happens, then all the plus and the minus remain the same. Error on the first qubit gives you a minus here, a minus there, or minus there, on the, depending on the first, second, or third qubit. Then that's the error that happened here. Then we do the decoding, which is exactly the inverse. It's going to transform these states into the following one. The first one is untouched. Well, we're undoing exactly what we've done here, so we end up with the state there. But if there's an error on the first qubit, it's going to flip this one on a 1 and 0 here and end up with the syndrome with a state 1-1. And if we have error on the second or third qubit, we have a syndrome here, but nothing has happened on that on the first qubit. We can then make a final gate, a Toffoli gate, a control bit, which is going to flip the first bit only if the last two are 1 and 1, which is exactly that case. And if we do this, we're going to recover the initial state that we have. This worked well until we have, if the error rate is e to the minus gamma for the first bit error, this is going to work. For the second two-bit error, it's not going to work, so that we get the probability of error 1 minus 3 gamma squared instead of roughly 1 minus gamma for small gamma. So we improve if gamma is small enough. So this is the kind of circuit that we implemented, like with some slight modification for improvement on optimization of certain of this parameter. And when we put all this together, what we end up is we measure the fidelity, the probability of getting back the state that we started with. And the green is with error correction, and the red is with decoding without error correction. This goes like indeed like e to the minus gamma. And this flattening at the top, which demonstrated that error correction has worked, or we have demonstrated that we were able to implement the operation in a reliable way. You can see it started a little bit lower here because doing the last gate, the Toffoli gate, takes a little bit of effort. It's not perfect, so it's a little bit lower. But it demonstrated that we can go and do some of those experiments and that we have enough control for demonstrating this system. More recently, we went to this molecule carbonic acid. Around here, I showed the spectra of each of those systems. There's 4 qubits here, carbon 1, carbon 2, carbon 3, carbon 4. 2 other ones, hydrogen 1, hydrogen 2, that makes 6 qubits. And here, there's this methyl group. It's 3 hydrogen, 3 identical hydrogen. We cannot distinguish them. They all have the same Larmor frequency, so we cannot count them as 3 qubits. But it turns out that if you start to add your angular momentum of 3 spin half particles, you'll end up with a spin 3 half particle and 2 spin half particle. The spin 3 half interacts slightly different with the carbon 1 than the spin half particles. So you can get rid of those parts, and then we can kind of come down to the spin half part of the methyl group and use it as a single qubit. So with this, you end up with a 7 qubit system, and you can go and manipulate things. First thing that we could do is not use those two hydrogen, having a 5-qubit system, and implement the 5-bit code that Manny mentioned, is the one which corrects for an arbitrary error on any one, but only one of the 5-qubit, but it could be a sigma x, sigma y, sigma z error. Now, one thing I want to show in my last little minute is that the number of gates that we have here is a lot larger than what we had in the 3-bit gate. When Manny mentioned about how much control we had in the system, he mentioned kind of about 2% error per gate. And if we go and do this, the average fidelity is about 75%, between 70 and 75%, about 25% error. There's about 50 gates, 2-bit gates in there, about 350 1-bit gates. So the 2-bit gates are kind of the slowest one. So if we say 50 gates, we have 25%, that gets roughly an order of 1% error per gate. I see Daniel is warning me. I better take his warning seriously. And I'm going to essentially finish by saying that one of the things that we really want to understand in this system is not only demonstrating that we can implement some very particular algorithm, but think about the idea of benchmarking. In the next 2, 5, 10, 20 years, there'll be a lot of small devices who do quantum information processing. We'll have to be able to compare them, being ion trap, NMR, superconducting, Josephson junction, linear optics, etc. And we'll need to find ways to say which one are the good one, which are the best one, and what are the weakness of different ones. So we have been thinking about ideas of how we would compare our experiment to, let's say, ion trap experiment. an idea of benchmarking is exactly this. And one of the suggestions we've had is to use error correction. Another one is to do what is called a cat state, where we would have all the spin pointing up in this molecule with 7, you have 7 spin pointing up and down at the same time. So it's a generalization of the EPR pair or the GAG state system. We went to do this with our molecule, and the demonstration that it was working is that in all the peaks that we have, only one should come out of the 4S at the end of the algorithm, and that's what we showed here. And again, in that system, we had about 75% fidelity of having the state that we claimed that we were getting. Definitely, there are difficult days. The more you do experiments with a system, you see its weakness and its strength. And in a liquid state NMR, the weakness are become obvious when you scale a number of spin. The first one is preparing the initial state, decaying of the state preparation exponentially as we increase the number of spin, which is due to the fact that we have very low polarization, this beta being 10 to the minus 5. So this is one weakness of this system. Another one is the amount of noise that we have compared to the gate time. The 2-bit gate time was about 100 hertz, 0.01 second. The Gorentz time about 1 second gives us about kind of 1% on this ratio. The third problem is we don't have resettable qubits. We start our system with an initial state, and then we go and do as much as we can. But in the error correction, for example, it would be very nice if we can go and do a second round of error correction or a third round of error correction and keep the information for longer and longer amount of time. In liquid state NMR, we can then do this. But there's a proposal by David Corey, which is a collaboration with people at Los Alamos, to use solid state NMR, where we could go down to polarization of the order of 1, and then we would not have this problem of preparing the initial state with a decay exponential with the number of qubits that we have. It would also have higher clock rate. The interaction between different qubits would be tens of kilohertz instead of 100 hertz. And also by using acoustic NMR, it's possible to erase some of the information in one qubit and reset them to a value. So with this, these three elements, we would be able to go further and maybe go to 20, 25, if we're in incredibly lucky, 30 qubit system, and understand of what are the difficulty of scaling from very small number to a large number. Again, there'll be some difficulty in the system, even in this system of solid state NMR. And one of them is that the nuclear spin, the Larmor frequency of nuclear spin, are squeezed in a certainly fixed amount of chemical shift that I've mentioned at the beginning. So if we all want to do all our experiments, let's say with all carbon, we have about 20 kilohertz at the string of the magnet that we have that we can put spin. If we want to do gates at, let's say, 1 millisecond, it tells us that we cannot have much more than 20 of those carbon spin there if they all spread out exactly equally, which is rather unlikely to find a molecule that way. By mixing different type of nuclei, we might be able to kind of squeeze enough in hydrogen, carbon, and maybe something else to get to some decent number. By that time, we'll get to some limitation. All of this tells us that we're quite far to get devices which are really doing quantum information processing as what we would like to. But we are making first step of understanding of how to control quantum mechanical systems. I think we are just at the border of a new territory of the quantum world in this laboratory to try to go and tease the system and try to make them manipulating information. I think there's lots of things to do, and that should give some hope for you guys, the young ones, to kind of make new discovery and see where we go. Thanks.